Some things shouldn't be transparent, like stop signs. But what you pay for should always be clear, like Hiller's True Transparency Pricing, always clearly itemized and never any hidden fees. Because you have the right to know what you're paying for. For more information, visit happyhiller.com/true-transparency-pricing. Happy you'll be, or the service is free.
Call the Happy Face Truck today.
104.5 The Zone, hitting the links with you on a Saturday morning. This is Talking Golf with Virgil Herring on 104.5 The Zone.
Good morning. It's time to talk a little golf. And you're listening to Talking Golf with Virgil Herring here on 104.5 The Zone. A final live show of the year. And it's going to be a championship version of it. Scott Fawcett, founder of the Decade System, will be joining us to help us navigate our way around the golf course. New golf stat analytic superstar, Lou Stagner, is going to be joining us to help us understand the true analytics of how to take care of our business. And then to get our head right and get our mind in the right place so that we can take all of this great information and perform the greatest we've ever performed, is joining me now from the mind side, Dr. Brett McCabe. Doc, how are you today, buddy?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Happy holidays to you, sir. And obviously, thank you for taking the time to join me on a Saturday morning.
Absolutely.
This week, or actually last week, a very interesting story popped up in golf in which a player at the web.com tour Q school had his club stolen in the final round and then shot a miraculous 63 in the final round with somebody else's clubs, a mixed match set, a putter that's too heavy, wedges off the rack. And that was probably the most asked question that I received in a long time. How did he do that? Doc, how did he do that?
Well, I think one thing you got to remember is, as players, we always fear that our skills are going away if we don't practice or if we don't do the 10 things that we're supposed to do in order to prepare. And our skills, they just decay a little bit, and they can recover. But the bigger thing is, golfers are unlike any other athletes in the world, okay? If you took a football player, a basketball player, and they couldn't practice for a couple of days, or something changed, they would probably be a little bit better to adapt, because the way that they train is to prepare for uncertainty. They game plan, but they understand that the opponent is going to do things that's going to make it, you know, difficult for them, and they're going to have to adjust. Golfers, though, prepare like our moms did when we were kids for the holidays. They're more worried about where everyone's going to sit. They're more worried about where all the casseroles are going to go. They're more worried about what time the food's going to hit the table than actually enjoying who came to the party. And so what happens is, golfers prepare, and when they prepare to play their perfect round, and in their mind, if it doesn't go according to plan, they get more tense and frustrated, and they don't play well. Well, the driver of that is expectations. So golfers tend to raise expectations the closer they get to a competitive round. And it doesn't matter if it's a weekend. It doesn't matter if it's a tournament. Well, as expectations rise, your ability to adjust and adapt goes down, because you're trying to deep down prove or may happen what you think it should happen, versus saying, you know what, I'm going to adjust. It's the embrace my variance mentality. Scott Fawcett talks about it, from embrace your variance with regards to their shot pattern. I say it about the way that you adjust in the world. This world is uncertain, and your golf course is uncertain, and your performance is uncertain. So how can you adjust? So a player loses his clubs and looks at it and goes, yeah, that's a really, really bad break, and I'm sure he was really upset. But then he had to do something with what he had. And so he could either buy into the noise and the clutter, or you could say, you know what, I got nothing to lose at this point besides my card, but I have nothing to lose. And so let's go play. And lo and behold, geez, man, those skills are actually pretty good, aren't they?
Yeah, I think that and I'm not saying that this is what he was really saying to himself, but it seems like this has always worked. It felt like he had a built-in excuse that everybody would empathize and sympathize with if he didn't do it. So the pressure was off. And it allowed him to just kind of just let it go, the no fear of the consequence. That's what I felt like when I was Well, you know, that's why I wanted you to speak on it, because it was so words that come out of your mouth. He played without the fear of consequence because he had a, for lack of a better term, a built-in excuse.
Yeah, to some degree, absolutely, and probably more so, Joe. So, I mean, look, I can imagine the panic, the fear, the frustration that was going on. I mean, you know, think about how we feel if we can't find our phone in the mornings, okay? Imagine the tools that you've set up your entire life waiting for, and you're in position to get your card, and all of a sudden it's gone. But, you know, if you look at it and say, okay, what's the lesson for my golf game? Is absolutely no expectations, no fear of consequences. I can adjust to anything that's out there, and I can actually play through what I have. And it's why that, you know, why the old saying, fear the sick golfer, is so true. It's why when players, you know, unfortunately on a Saturday morning have gone out on a Friday night with their families and had one too many glasses of wine, they don't feel well, they play really well because they're just trying to make it to the next hole. If you've ever played with a fever or got the flu and you're like, look, I don't know if I'm going to make it through 18 holes, but I'm just going to keep plodding along. And all of a sudden, you play really well. And so expectations are tough. And, you know, expectations are something that the better you are, the better you can learn to help manage them. But I'm on the road this week seeing many of my tour players as kind of at year end. And expectations are something that every one of them struggle with. We all struggle with it. It's learning to balance it is what's important.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I think that one of the things that I love about what you do is that you're a realist. There's no Pollyanna. There's no such thing as perfect. Let's accept the fact that this game is really hard, and we're human. We have emotions. Things pop in and out of our head. How do we cope with it is really one of the biggest challenges. And to me, one of the things that I really love where golf is right now is that we've never had more information that is useful to kind of stack on top of each other for us to play our best golf. I mean, we got professionals like you that put our head in the right place. We got technology that can verify that. We got Scott Fawcett basically putting out a great blueprint of how to mathematically tear apart a golf course. We got golf teachers everywhere that have the greatest technology. It's just learning how to stack them up in a non-perfect idea and how to get the best out of what you said, the variance. Get your variance and playability, and then learn how to play with what it is that you have. And that's what I think your gift is. You help people do that better than anybody I've seen.
Well, I appreciate that. I think the one thing to remember, too, is with all this information can also be a challenge. You know, we get to a point where we get a paradox of choice, where this paradox of choice is we have too many options. We have too many choices. We have too many shots to hit. We have too many things we have to do. And as teachers and as coaches and as players, we have to learn to limit the amount of choices that we have by coming to clear decision pathways. And the better we can do with that, the better our mind can work. If our mind is still deciding between three choices, it's not going to be 100% on the choice that we make. And so as coaches, we still have to help players learn to play. I had dinner with a young aspiring professional last night, and he's like, look, my swing is better than it's ever been on TrackMan. He said, my stroke is better than it's ever been on SAM, and my scores are going the wrong way. And he said, it's not a one-week trend, it's a one-month, six-week trend. And I said, well, what are we doing? Are we trying to win a modeling contest, or are we trying to get the ball in the hole? And he kind of laughed, and he said, you know, you're right. And he said, because my communication has been, yeah, my swing always feels on point, but I'm not scoring. Listen, this is still a game to be played and a game to try to succeed through. And to do that, we got to get the ball in the hole. And if that means that, you know, if I'm chipping, I got to play the ball further back in my stance, but I can use the club appropriate, and it's not what the average person should be doing, but it works for me, then do it. If that's what gets the ball in the hole for you. You know, we're sometimes so caught up in form because we have so much information that we forget function. And we are all different. We all have our own psychological fingerprint. It's all unique to us, and our experience is unique. The goal that I want all my players to know is I want them to find them. And, you know, like I said, this week I'm doing annual reviews with all my guys, and it's so unique. Not one of the guys I'll meet with will have the same meeting as another one. And I actually had a guy yesterday. I did a podcast with two of my guys, and we were sitting around talking, and they were kind of talking about their different ways that they go about it mentally, and it was so unique to see. Both of these guys are multiple winners, and you could watch them talk to each other like, wait a minute, we don't do the same thing. And that's what I think is brilliant, is that everybody has their unique experience, and it's finding what your way is that matters.
Amen to that. I mean, if it, wake up, everybody. You just heard a dime. That was incredible. Absolutely it pure insight to what it really takes. I would imagine one of the things that is so interesting that you've added to your repertoire this year is your playing lessons, in which you've brought people in. And I've always thought that that was maybe one of my better gifts to the players, is the playing lesson, which is often overlooked in the lesson taking process. But I can't imagine how awesome it would be to have your mental coach there, because it'd be interesting to hear, like I'm sure you're doing it, is what's going through people's head at different points in the round. And one of the things that I've always wondered about, which you would say, is there's that whole 12 through 14 laps that occurs in a lot of places, even on the tour, where maybe it's low blood sugar or not hydrated enough or a variety of things. But post 12 through 14 are a very big transitionary in a round almost always. What are you trying to do when you're on those playing lessons and you're seeing some round fatigue and or hunger / dehydration? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, there's no doubt. I mean, look, playing lessons give me a chance to get in and see it. I like to have players play with multiple other players. I don't like to do solo playing lessons, because usually a player plays very, very well by themselves and they're having a good time and they're relaxed. So you put them in with other people and they do really well. I think the important thing is, listen, most golfers, it doesn't matter what level they play at, are tremendously bad hydrators and eaters. And you're out on the golf course for 5 hours playing a sport that has a tremendous cognitive load to it. You know, makes you think a lot and use a lot of mental energy. And we're not feeding the brain, okay? So what happens is the brain drops before the body does. But we blame the swing breaking down on 13. When reality is, you go in at the turn, you have a hot dog, go in the turn, you have a power bar, but you're already in a nutritional deficit by that point. I like my players, and this is something everybody can do in 2019, is try to eat every 2 to 3 holes something little. And let's see if it improves your performance 16, 17, and 18, because you're coming down the stretch. But when you get into the dark cave of boredom, you know, it's somewhat, you know, you're in the grind point. You got to be better. And so one of the simplest ways to do it is just to eat. Just eat. I mean, look, we all love to eat. Eat. It's not going to hurt you.
No doubt. Doc, how can my listeners get a chance to get in touch with you and your brilliance?
Well, I don't know about my brilliance, but you can go to themindside.com and you can find out everything that we have going on. Follow me on Twitter at Dr. Brett McKay. Follow me on Instagram. You know, I think there's a lot of different ways to learn the game, and there's a lot of different things you can to do to grow your game. I want to make your average better. I don't want to make your better. You can already know how to shoot low when you do shoot low, but I want to make your average round better so you can save 2 or 3 shots here or there and you watch your handicap drop.
I love it. Doc, thank you so much for taking the time to join me, buddy. Merry Christmas and Happy New Year to you and your family. I look forward to having you on again. Thanks, buddy.
You got it. All the best for 2019.
Thanks, buddy. All right, we return. We're going to get a new level of analytics to help us understand the game a little bit better. So stick around. You're listening to Talking Golf with Virgil Herring here on 104.5 The Zone. Welcome back, and you are listening to Talking Golf with Virgil Herring here on 104.5 The Zone. If you've been listening to the show long enough, you know that I love analytics, and I love how analytics can really help you maybe change your expectations. I think most people have expectation problems when it comes to how close they think they should hit it to the hole or how far they should hit their tee shot, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, there's many people out there, some brilliant guys who's kind of got this thing rolling, but there's a new cowboy in town. There's a new sheriff that's bringing a whole new level of understanding to the analytics, and it's coming from a different angle. And I just felt compelled to ask to get him on the show, and fortunately for us, he said yes. Lou Stegner, Golf Stat Pro. Lou, how are you today, buddy?
Good, Virgil. Thanks for having me tonight.
Oh, well, my pleasure. Well, thank you. So tell us a little bit about your background and how you got yourself into this this golf analytics.
Sure, yeah. I guess starting on the golf side, I started playing a long time ago in my teens, and like everyone else, fell in love with the game. And played down to low single digits for a while, but now I hover in the 10 range, and I've always tried to use analytics to help my own game out. On the professional side, worked in technology for a couple of decades, and currently I work for a large private company with about 40,000 employees, and I run the analytics team there. And every day I get to work with analyst developers and data scientists, and we get to work on some really cool stuff. And
Go ahead.
Yeah, on the golf analytics side, it's something I've been doing for a long time, really for my own game. And I've had a couple of transformational moments in the analytics space. One was when Brody's book came out, Every Shot Counts, which anyone who likes golf analytics, everyone's read that. And the second was when I saw some videos from Scott Fawcett on his Decade system. And, you know, both of those guys, their work is so it's so simple, but it's so simple, it's brilliant, and it's very elegant. And it was just a light bulb moment for me. And from there, I've just started to build upon what I do and decided to start a blog and get some stuff out there.
Well, you know, I always when I have Mark Brody on, I call him the Godfather of golf analytics, and he is the Godfather. And I think it's interesting is that when he throws out these things that turn into strokes gained, whatever, there's always a bunch of next level things, and one of them that is this clutch factor, like how people are playing under the gun within a certain amount of strokes of the lead with nine holes to play. Talk to us about how you kind of dug into this, and what are you finding?
Well, really, it started with, for the guys that like analytics, there's a podcast out there called The Perfect Number. It's run by a guy named Will Haskett. He's a broadcaster on PGA Tour Radio. And a couple of weeks ago, he had some guys on from the 15th Club. They're the analytics firm that helped the European team with their analytics for the Ryder Cup. And we all know how that turned out. And a couple of weeks ago on his podcast, they were talking about clutch factor and how the 15th Club used that as part of their analytics for some of their work for the European team. And this is something that that Will's talked about in his podcast a few times before. And after I heard them talking about it, it just got me really curious as to how I would approach that for golf. You've seen some other sports starting to create some analytics around clutch factor, but golf is a little bit different. At any given time, there's 80 or 90 guys on the course. They're across different holes. They're finishing at different times. And it's not always just a single event that you're trying to measure. Clutch for a golfer could be near the end of the season, maybe trying to finish in the top 125, or maybe they've missed a few cuts in a row, and they're trying to make the cut on a Friday afternoon, or maybe it's someone first time being in contention. So golf is a little bit different compared to other sports. So the approach that I came up with was I looked at all the data for a tournament, and I focused in on the last three seasons. And basically what I needed to do was, for every single player, for every single minute of every round, I needed to calculate where they stood in relation to everyone else. And once I did that, once I had all those calculations, I could then know for every hole that they played, how many shots were they behind the leader, or were they tied for the lead? And then once I had all that, I could calculate how they played in different situations. And that's where the real hard part came in, was trying to define what a clutch situation was. And I couldn't really come up with a great answer. So I built some software that started off with allowing you to select the round, the holes that you wanted to look at, and the shots behind or in the lead that the player was, and let you dive into some of that stuff.
Did you find that it came up with a strokes gained comparative? Is that what you found?
Yeah, that's what I used. I used strokes gained, and I look at strokes gained across all the categories. So total strokes gained off the tee, approach to green, tee to green, around the green, and strokes gained putting. Huh. And the thing, you know, what jumped out at me initially, and I thought that my work was wrong for a while, leaders, when a player gets into the lead, they do not play very well. The average leader for the last three seasons, they lose nearly 0.2 of a shot per hole when they have the lead. And as I dug into it and looked at it, it really became apparent that in the golf space, it's like cycling, or at least my understanding of cycling. You get someone that runs out into the lead, and they charge ahead of the pack, and then they have this pack that's chasing them, and the pack almost always catches them. So we have this ebb and flow in a golf tournament where players scratch their way into the lead, and then they drop back once they get into that lead. And it's really interesting to see that. And they play substantially worse than any other group that you'd look at in a tournament once they get into the lead.
That's interesting. There's two things I take out of that. One of it is I tell these kids all the time, is that let's take Tiger Woods and Jack Nicklaus out of the equation. More golf tournaments are lost than won. And to learn how to finish the race and to learn how to keep your eyes forward, because the other part is, as I find that once you get in the lead, people look up in the rearview mirror to see how far they've come. And they stop to look, oh, wow, I'm in the lead. And you got to keep your head down. And the Payne Stewart called, you got to finish the race. And he was another very good closer. But Tiger Woods is, in my opinion, skewed our view of what leaders did, because once he got it, he kind of never gave it away. But that is definitely not the norm. And I think that that's pretty profound. Who had the best strokes gained in that particular category?
Well, of all of the leaders over the past 3 years, there's been 363 different players to lead a tournament in the fourth round. This is across over 2,000 holes and 117 events that I looked at. Dustin Johnson led 93 holes. He led the most holes of anyone. Justin Thomas was in second. And every single player, when you look at them by the number of holes that they've led, had negative strokes gained as a leader. You have to go all the way down to Bryce Garnett, who led 13 holes over the last three seasons, and he is the first player that had positive strokes gained when he had the lead, which is really fascinating to me. And you know, Dustin Johnson, who just kills par fives, he lost almost 0.4 of a stroke just on par fives when he had the lead. Jason Day lost almost a full stroke on par fives when he had the lead, 0.8 of a shot. And it's just really interesting to see the dynamics of how things change once these players get into the lead.
That is so interesting. Wow. Another very popular conversation, it stems all the way back to Ben Hogan and talking about position in the fairway and getting the best angle to the flag stick. And you know, I would always start like with anybody who wanted to do that. Well, you're not Ben Hogan. That the idea that you have any kind of pinpoint accuracy at 295 makes me laugh. And
right.
And my next guest obviously is going to be able to help us with that is Scott Fawcett. But it'd be interesting to hear what you have to say about what you found when it comes to finding the best angles and what did it all mean.
Yeah, this is always a hot topic out in the golf world, playing the right angles. We've all heard that. You can't watch a broadcast without hearing someone say, pins tucked on the left, you want to be on the right side of the fairway to open up the hole and give yourself the best angle. And so what I did was I looked at the data from 2018 and every par four, and I really dissected every tee shot. Where did it end up? I took the fairway and I broke the fairway up into sections, and I could determine if a ball was in the center part of the fairway, the right side of the fairway, the left side of the fairway. And then I went out onto the PGA Tour's Twitter website, and I got every pin sheet from 2018 and kind of painstakingly worked my way through and mapped out where every hole location was for all these par fours. And then once I did that, I had all of the data that I could then use to say, well, the pin's on the left. How close is it to the left? What happens when the players are in the left side of the fairway, the middle of the fairway, the right side of the fairway, or in either rough on the side, and really see what the strokes gained were to really unpack that. And then I broke it down by distance as well. I looked at chunks. So I looked at 70 to 100 yards, 100 to 125, et cetera, and was able to see what those strokes gained looked like when players had good angles. And what was really interesting is nearly every way you look at it, when players are in the center of the fairway, they have the best strokes gained. And oftentimes when players have the best angle to the pin, they have the lowest strokes gained. And it just goes against all conventional wisdom. And if I were to speculate a bit, I think a lot of it is because of what, you know, the next guy's going to tell you, Scott Fawcett. It's about shot patterns. And I think the mindset of players, when they have that quote-unquote good angle to the pin, they're always told to be more aggressive. And when they get more aggressive, they leave themselves short-sighted a little bit more, which is what I'm seeing. And when they leave themselves short-sighted a little more, it's tougher to get up and down and make that par. The opposite, when you have the bad angle to the flag, I agree that it visually it doesn't open up the hole, and it's tougher to get comfortable hitting a shot when you have a bad angle. And so what players do there is they play more conservative, and they play further away from the hole. And that conservative play offsets the bad angle that they have, and they end up performing better generally from that side of the hole than when they have the good angle, which is really fascinating. And then my last speculation is, I think on the middle, that kind of puts players in the sweet spot when they're in the middle of the fairway, where they have this good balance of being not too aggressive, but not too conservative. And because of that, they result in the lowest number of birdie opportunities that are reasonable and the lowest number of short-sighted attempts.
Interesting. What is in the pipeline coming up for you that you can't wait to spit out the analytics on?
Well, I had some cool conversations this week. One was Dr. Brandon Horvath. He is a doctor at the Turf Grass Science Program at University of Tennessee. I'm going to be doing some really cool stuff with them around turf grass management and how it impacts the game. I'm working on a next generation strokes gained around the green stat that I think when it comes out, it's really going to shift and change how we think about short games and how we think about who the good short game players really are. I'm really excited about that one. I expect to have something there in the next few weeks.
Fantastic. Well, one of the things that I'm looking forward to, both with on this radio show and my new podcast that'll be coming out in 2019, is having you on every time you come up with a new nugget so that you can help us understand the game a little bit better and how awesome the awesome players are and yet how average they are simultaneously. Luke, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to come on my show. How can my listeners follow your great information?
Well, they can find me at golfstatpro.com and on Twitter. You can find me at Lou Stagner on Twitter.
Luke, Merry Christmas to you and your family. Hope you have a happy new year, and you will be hearing from me, and we will be having you on multiple times in 2019, buddy. Thank you so much for coming on.
Looking forward to it. Thanks, Virgil.
All right. Awesome. I cannot wait to have more of that, because he's uncovering a new layer. It's like peeling back the onion. All right, we return. We're headed to the Orca Driving Range, so stick around. You're listening to Talking Golf with Virgil Herring here on 104.5 The Zone.
Nobody said it was easy.
Welcome back, and you are listening to Talking Golf with Virgil Herring here on 104.5 The Zone. So this time every Saturday morning, we make the turn and decide it's a better idea to go to the range, the Orca Driving Range. And today, there's a lot of information in today's show. Our next guest at the beginning of the next segment is going to be Scott Fawcett, who, in my opinion, is the player of the year in 2018 as it pertains to learning and playing golf. Probably has impacted my teaching and my playing personally more than anything. I would even say more so than TrackMan and Focus Band. And it's a revelation. So what is it that you can take from today's show and apply to your game? So we'll start with the range first, okay? Everybody wants to hit the golf ball better. Yep, I agree. I spend my entire life coaching that particular piece. So what is required? What is required is, generally speaking, from a balanced address position, you know, front to back, left to right, not too far forward, not too far backward, is a pivot that is basically coiling your shoulders into your trail leg. And as you've seen me describe on the Golf Channel, there's three ways to do it. A front leg pivot, where the front knee compresses more, the trail leg extends more, so it's a stack and tilt-ish golf swing. Then there's more of a centered pivot, where the front knee flexes a little, the trail leg extends some, and it doesn't move much, doesn't look like it's on the front leg, doesn't look like it's on the back leg. It's a centered turn, And I'd call that more neutral and probably what you see more of. And then there's the trail leg pivot, where there's maybe a little more flex maintained in the trail leg. And you know, like a Henrik Stenson, Phil Mickelson, and Tiger in his prime had this bump to the right that loaded up that right side a lot. And you know, so there's no right or wrong there, but you have to have one of the three. And from there, everybody's searching for an impact position. And at the end of the day, there's only one real true impact position, which is the hands are, you know, off the inside of the lead thigh, and the left wrist is slightly in flexion and the right wrist is slightly in extension or bent back. And then from there you swing to a balanced finish. I always say the speed limit. I want you to swing as fast as you possibly can while finishing with your right or your trail shoulder facing the target. Once you have that, you're going to learn how to pay close attention to your shot variance, which Scott's going to talk about next, and how important it is to not predict perfect, but predict the scatter. What's the scatter shot? What's the shotgun effect? Where's the most probability that you can aim so that the vast majority of your shots are unpenalized and unobstructed? From there, it is truly a gravity game. Can you keep your ball below the hole, unpenalized and unobstructed? So you're trying to figure out, where can I place my ball on the green, hopefully, but if not on the green, not in the water, not in a bunker, not out of bounds, below the hole. If we spend most of our time chipping uphill with gravity on our team, we have a pretty good chance. But when we get gravity against us, our chances of getting up and down are significantly lower. And then when you multiply that with short-sightedness, usually coming from over-aggressive play, our chance of getting up and down drop probably in the 40 to 50%. It's really important to understand that most of the time when you're looking at your statistics and you say, wow, I shot whatever today, and that's 6 or 7 shots higher than normal, and I was terrible in my up and down game. Were you really terrible in your up and down game? Or did you put yourself in positions that Phil couldn't have gotten it up and down from? I've had many conversations with David Ogren, who's now a big-time teacher in San Antonio, but was a PGA Tour player. And he often talks about, it took him a while to realize that many of his great scoring rounds were because he had most of his opportunities were below the hole. And many of his rounds of golf that he played, what he considered awesome golf, he didn't score as well because most of his putts came from across the slope or down the slope. So learning how to position your ball, maybe not as if you're trying to position it like Hogan may have thought, like he was going to hit it, you know, 5 feet under the hole. But if you keep your ball below the hole for your chip shots and your putts, it is much easier to control your distance on your close lag chip or lag putt. And that is really one of the biggest keys. And then from there, once you understand your scatter and you understand how to manage it, you all of a sudden become much more of a mental champion. And that's where Dr. McCabe kicks in. He is very capable of helping you move past expectations and getting proper game plans set up based around what you tend to do. All of this leads us to playing golf without letting emotion dictate what we're going to do. And emotion is what really, we're humans and we're supposed to be dealing with that. And there's nothing wrong with being emotional. But almost everything in life, including golf, when we make decisions that are emotional, generally speaking, it's a disaster. So when we have a game plan that is set up based around what we tend to do, with a very clear understanding of what the golf course is giving us, we almost play the golf in a cruise control mindset where everything is already planned out for us. Now all we have to do is execute our average. Executing our average really narrows the bell curve and allows us to play our best more often. And what I can't wait to hear what Scott's got to say is he is also proving that the best more often also does not limit how great your low rounds can be. So when we have Scott on coming next, it's going to be very interesting to hear him talk about this because he just had a bunch of guys qualify for the web.com tour at Q School shooting the lowest scores they've ever shot in a shootout format. So stick around for that. So when we return, it will be the Decade System founder, Scott Fawcett, joining us. So stick around. You're listening to Talking Golf with Virgil Herring here on 104.5 The Zone. welcome back. Time to finish strong here on 104.5 The Zone as you are listening to Talking Golf with Virgil Herring. What a great year it has been, and there's no better way for us to end the year than having the... Are we having problems there, Mr. Producer? Getting voicemail. We are trying to get... I just had a text message from him. We are trying to get Scott Fawcett on. He seems to be... I know he just sent me a text message, so he's waiting to hear from us. But at the end of the day, what I would call the MVP of 2018 for golf for me is Scott Fawcett. And he's going to, when we get him on, he's going to be talking a lot similarly to what we talked about with Lou, which was, you know, what is it that allows us to manage the game better and how we pull this off in a mentality that allows us to make the best decisions all the time. And I strongly encourage you can go to YouTube and find Scott at playinglesson.com or the Scott Fawcett in the Playing Lesson and find him in a situation where he breaks down the when to hit your tee shot, like when to hit driver. And it's basically this: when you have 60 yards between your fairway troubles, so you got trees on the right, water on the left. When you have 60 yards or more between that, you rip driver every single time. When you're hitting, when you have a water hazard or a bunker or something of the like in the way of that, you will definitely sense that you need to lay back of that. Then you hit three wood or whatever club that keeps you out of trouble. The most important thing to remember about managing is stay away from penalties. The penalty is what's killing people, is the erratic tee shot, the erratic iron shot. And I'm not sure if it has anything to do with that you're not good enough to do it. Maybe if you played from the right tee box, it'd be better. But at the end of the day, learning how to play the game in a simple form that allows your average to perform best will be better. And what the analytics allow us to do is allows us to find this place where you know what you can and can't do. So like most people think that when you hit a wedge shot, the best that you can do is, I mean, what you should be doing is hitting it inside of 5 feet. When in all actuality, hitting it inside of 5 feet, nobody's ever done for the year. And I think it's kind of baffling to me as I get junior golfers all the time that they don't hit, they hit it to like 11 feet and they're just totally disgusted and disappointed. And yet when they do that, their scores go up because they're trying so hard. Finally, we have him. Welcome to the show. My 2018 MVP for helping us play the game better, Scott Fawcett. Scott, how are you today, buddy?
Sick and apparently forgot to turn off my Do Not Disturb. I'm not afraid to make fun of myself for stupid stuff.
Oh, no worries, man. That was just an easy bogey we can get up and down from next hole.
Awesome.
So one of the things that I love about your work is the fact that you really help take emotion out of the decision-making process. And we had Lou on earlier today, and we were talking about this whole Ben Hogan idea of, you know, trying to place your driver in the exact correct spot to provide us the best angle to the hole. And he actually demonstrated that you actually lose strokes slightly by being in that angle, maybe because you get over-aggressive, which is right down your alley. What is your findings?
I thought that was an amazing point, actually, sorry, carry on with your question, then I'll...
No, that is my question. Well, what'd you think about that?
Yeah. You know, it's funny. So, again, like how I, you know, self-deprecating, made a joke about myself there. I know a lot of people think that I'm the smartest guy on the earth, but when I saw Lou's stuff on Twitter for the first time just a week or two ago, I was like, this is different. Now, if he can get out of the ShotLink database what he's saying he can, it's different, and I want to understand how he's doing it. Again, I am here to learn also. I was going to Philadelphia. Luckily, that's where Lou lives. So I met the guy for lunch just a couple days ago, and it was unbelievable listening to the logic that he was bringing to it. Again, math just isn't hard. It's funny to me listening to Brandle try to explain Z-scores and standard deviations on No Layup's podcast the other day. Like, math isn't challenging. Figuring out how to ask the correct question out of math is the challenge of math. And Lou's brought something totally different to it than I've seen. And it's really, really good. So his logic there, I mean, it holds water. I don't have a clue if it's accurate or not. There's no way to really know if it is. But I think his assessment that, man, I've got a better angle here, so I'm going to go attack it. And, you know, that podcast was a lot of what I was going to try to talk about, assuming I got on here on time. But I liked a lot of what Brandle and I need to know the No Laying Up guy's name, whoever the guy was doing the interview, I liked a lot of their content. But it's just amazing to me how they're still both stuck in this fallacy of hunting angles. You know, Brandle was talking about the 18th at Sawgrass, and it was just such a great hole because if you don't challenge the left side, then you have to come in over the ridge and the green, and you just have to stand up there and hit a draw. He then went on to say, I mean, who's going to do that? No amateur golfer can do that. And he says, you know, shoot, very few professionals can do that. No professionals have the ability to do that. He's talking about putting a ball intentionally in the left side of a 30-yard wide fairway. That's not possible. And it's sad that, you know, Brandle blocked me for literally no reason, and the No Laying Up guys refused to give me any sort of a platform because I challenge the architectural envelope. But they're just not good enough. And this is what's fun for me is I get to sit with a guy like Hal Sutton this year and actually talk about strategy and that hole. And Hal's like, I stood up there and hit a cut off that tee. Well, he won in 1983 pre-Tiger. He won in 2000 with Tiger. That's just not how it works. And Brandle can flat out play golf. The dude got up to 53rd in the world, he said. The dude's one of the best players in the history of the game. And this is where I want to say, like, most people challenge him as though, like, he only won once on tour, and that means he wasn't very good. So he's really, really good at golf. But what I would add to that is, potentially, the reason he didn't win more was this basic lack of understanding of shot patterns, distribution, and result in expectation. I mean, again, I know I'm just trying to get all this stuff in since I didn't answer in time. But, you know, then the No Laying Up guy went on to say that number six at Carnoustie was his favorite tee shot of the year to watch. Because people like who would or wouldn't challenge Hogan's Alley? Nobody. I just put up on Twitter an image of Jason Day when he was number one in the world and number three in strokes gained driving, his shot pattern 74 yards wide. To the left of that of Hogan's Alley, or Hogan's Alley, I guess, specifically between the bunkers and road, is 26. Nobody, even Hogan, is good enough to challenge that intentionally and not to put too many balls out of bounds, making the play not work. It's simply not possible. It sounds cool on paper, but it's just not the way it works. The satellites have destroyed that basic kind of course management. I mean, and even like the rock on number eight at Pebble Beach, where, you know, that's in theory your center line. Even this rock's not, it's off center. I can tell you that from space. And for some reason, that's what they seem to not really appreciate or understand. And again, it's not trying to be contentious. I'm just saying, actually put some thought into this. Don't be stuck in your hole and or your cave and come on out. It works.
Oh, that's so good. What I know we have like a little bit less than 2 minutes. That's okay. A little bit less than 2 minutes. But I thought it was interesting, if you could expand on this real quickly. Your strategy often gets considered conservative, played aggressively to conservative targets, but you just had a bunch of your players play really good at the web.com shootout to get their card. And they performed just fine. If you don't make bogeys, it's hard to shoot over par.
It's real hard. And that's like what you just said right there. Norman Jeong, here's a kid that hammers it. And he was number three in the world when he turned professional. He was 0-for-5 in cuts on the PGA Tour last year. That's literally impossible. I met him for the first time the week before. He called me up. He's like, dude, I'm intrigued. I'm not doing something right. I went out to L.A. I worked with him for a day. I lead off by saying, stop trying to make birdies, even though we know next week the final stage of Q School is going to be a birdie fest shootout. My advice is stop trying to make birdies. And here goes a dude that was 0-for-5 in cuts, just had some dude fly to L.A. to tell him to stop trying to make birdies. And he shoots either 26 or 27 under and finishes second. Like, it's just so frustrating when I get people who don't know what I teach, or more importantly, how I teach it, telling me that what I teach doesn't work. You know, again, back to the fried egg nonsense during the Nelson. He's telling me that my stuff won't account for slopes and ridges. And, oh, that's funny. A player who is extraordinarily familiar with decades won.
No doubt. I love
it. Laughable.
Scott,
sorry for being late, dude.
No worry, buddy.
I really am.
You're my MVP of 2018. Thank you for all your contributions to the game and my teaching. Have a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year, buddy.
Google Decade Golf. You'll find me.
That's right.
Thanks, Virgil.
Thank you, buddy. Have a great one.
Bye. Right,
thank you for making us part of your Saturday, because without you, there is no talking golf. Have a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. We'll see you in January.